He told my new sweetmate that her artificially flavored microwave popcorn was shit. Despite his temper, he'd had an air of melancholy, even offering to buy me a leather jacket at a nice clothing shop called Agnes B. I refused because it seemed too expensive. It seemed weighty, as if it really meant something else, but I didn't understand what, or what to say to him, being sad myself. Lonely again without his company in this strange place I was supposed to like. That summer when I returned, my father treated me strangely, not talking with me unless he snapped at me with contempt. I was too thin. Lorene told her friend I was anorexic. I wanted to eat, but store-bought food tasted like cardboard, and I didn't know how to cook. Lorene kept buying me sandwiches. When I went to see Dr. Lake, I discovered my father had decided not to pay the bill anymore. Dr. Lake said, "No one has the right to refuse you medical care," and reduced his fee to $25 per session, which I paid myself. Over the summer, I worked at Hidden Villa, where my mother had taught the art classes years ago. I was a camp counselor for groups of children who came to learn about the animals and the farm. Since I'd left for college, the checks from Jeff Housen that helped pay her rent had stopped coming, and my mother could not afford to stay in the house in Rinconada and would have to move. My mother was now dating the software engineer with a black belt in karate she'd met in yoga class. She would move in with him until she could find her own place. He owned a small house in unincorporated Menlo Park. Unincorporated, as far as I could tell, meant that there were no sidewalks, just gutters, and the trees were bushy and more abundant, not planted in orderly rows. He said she could stay until she found another place, but his house didn't have enough space for me. She was in the midst of packing up the house in Rinconada one Saturday, with the help of some friends. I was supposed to help too. She was directing traffic, moving quickly on the path under the wisteria bush between the garage and the house through the spots of sunlight. "Come on, Lisa," she said. I found myself standing over boxes and stacks of books and clothing and dishes, all the things of our lives, our past together, unable to move. "Pack," she said, "please." But I could no longer distinguish between items to discard or keep, or what boxes they went in, and my legs were paralyzed. Soon she gave up on me. In the late afternoon, after the others had stopped packing, I sat at my mother's desk as she cooked for me, and I was comfortable for the first time in days. I knew I would soon eat and be nourished. I didn't want to leave the circle of her care. But that night, my father had tickets to Cirque du Soleil. Even though he had hardly talked to me or looked at me since I returned from college, he wanted me to go to the circus and had become fixated on my attentions to my little brother. I was thin and depressed, like a rag doll, unsure of myself, trying but unable to please him. I decided I wouldn't go. "I can't go tonight," I said to him on the phone at my mother's house. "I'm sorry." "You have to go," he said. I was not sure why my presence could be so important to him, unless it had to do with watching my brother, who might need to be walked around the circus tent. "I need to stay. I need to eat. Mom's cooking for me," I said. My mother was looking at me from the kitchen with concern. "Lise, you're not being part of this family," he said. "Frankly, we think you're being really selfish." "I want to be part of the family," I said. "If you skip the circus, you'll need to move out." "Fine," I said and hung up, because at his words I was filled with an unexpected wave of relief, as if I had stepped from a small dark room into a bright, open field. Right away I called Kevin, the neighbor. "He told me to move out," I said, "that if I didn't go to the circus tonight, I was supposed to leave." I liked the feeling of openness it gave me, the permission. "What do you think I should do?"
"Let's move you out," Kevin said.
"When?"
"Tonight, while they're at the circus."
Years before, he'd also moved Dorothy out of her father's house. He'd saved her from her own father, and they'd married young.
"And then?"
He knew my mother was moving and I didn't have a place to stay.
You can live with us, he said.
This was the answer I had wished for. That night, I met Kevin at his house at dusk, and we drove a block to my father's house to gather my things. I took most of my clothing and shoes, my toiletries, some of my personal letters, left my CDs. Even though I knew my father must be at the circus, which was at least a 30-minute drive away, I kept on feeling he could come back at any second and catch us. Kevin was also not in a mood to dawdle, more serious than usual. I threw my things into a bag. What would it be like when my father returned and found me gone? It seemed incredibly sad then, in a way it hadn't been when I imagined how it would be from the conversation before. The shock. It was possible that he did not want me to leave, that he helped cause the very losses he didn't want, that he wasn't able to keep in his life the kind of people who might explain this pattern to him. Had he kept them, he wouldn't have listened to them anyway. It was only much later that I had the audacious idea that with my departure from my mother's house for the second 6 months before I left home, and then for college far away, he had felt abandoned and even betrayed. It wasn't fair, but may have been true nonetheless. He had been negligent about spending time with me and caring for me. But now that it was time for me to go, he was angry at my departure. At the time, I would have told you that he hated me and that he must have hardly noticed my presence, that it could not possibly be missing me that had stirred him to such a fury. I was not enough to miss. It wasn't until my early 30s that I realized that the loss of me might be what he was mad about. Many parents spent time with their children for years and had learned to abide loss in smaller increments. But he was new at it. My father had come to visit me in London when I was in my mid-20s, and we had walked to Green Park, found a bench, and sat side by side. "If I was an old man, I'd be out here all the time sitting on one of these benches," he said, looking around. But there were no old men out that morning, and the other benches were empty.
"You know," he'd said then, "those years you lived with us, those were the best years for me."
This was news. I didn't know what to say. For me, they'd been difficult, and I thought for him, they were some of the worst.
"Take just what you need," Kevin said, "and leave a note."
I wrote, "Dear Steve, I've moved out, as you said I should if I didn't go to the circus. I hope you will call me tomorrow." "Right where you're staying," Kevin said. "I'm staying at Kevin and Dorothy's house," and I wrote their phone number, and, "I love you." It seemed less real now that we were doing it than it had seemed talking about it this afternoon. I kept on hoping to relax, but not to relax so much that I gave Kevin the notion I was accustomed to my salvation. Why did the neighbors choose to help me? For years, they were aware of how my father treated me, and they were profoundly uncomfortable with it. Dorothy's father, also a prominent, charismatic man, had been cruel to her. They had enough money to help me. They didn't like the idea that because my father had money and was surrounded by people who pandered to him, he could get away with being cruel to a child. When I asked many times over the next few years how I could possibly repay them, they said I should pay it forward when I could. Help some other kid.
"Let's keep it moving," Kevin said.
On my bed at their house that night, Dorothy had left a tray with Russian tea cookies dusted in sugar and wrapped in plastic, a thermos of herbal tea, and a welcome note. In the morning, before work at the farm, I cracked my neck, pulling the tendon across the bone, and gave myself a crick. I couldn't move out of the contorted position all day. My father did not call or return my calls. The rest of the summer continued in a similar way. Living with the neighbors, working at the farm, seeing my mother, speculating about my father and what he was thinking, Dorothy cooked for me. I decided not to take drugs for depression, as my therapist had recommended at the beginning of the summer. but kept telling myself positive things for all the negative ones that seemed to pop into my mind. At first very frequently, and then less frequently. And by the end of the summer, most of the cruel and knifing voices had gone away, and I was not depressed anymore. Or too thin. I'm going to ask Steve to buy me a house, my mother said on the phone during my sophomore year of college. She was still living with her boyfriend. I stayed with the neighbors during school breaks. He'll never do it, I said. I'm going to keep on asking until he does. She had never owned a house. In all the years I was growing up, he had not bought us a house. We had never lived in a house we owned. Surely if he had been willing, he would have done it then. I wondered why she thought she could get it now, especially now that I had already left home, and he wasn't even talking with me. And why, if she could convince him to do things, she hadn't done it sooner. The idea that it was possible, that it might have even been possible before, enraged me, even if I wanted her to have it. In fact, several months later, he agreed. She found a house for sale in Menlo Park that met his criteria. Within a certain radius of his house, and less than $400,000. It was a thin-walled, two-bedroom wooden house on the busy Alameda de las Pulgas, with a nice back garden. He'd said it had to be close to his house so that he could see it before buying it. But in the end, he didn't even come to look before he bought the house in her name. The summer after my sophomore year at Harvard, I got a job working at the Stanford Genetics Lab, as I had done during high school. This would be the last time I lived in Palo Alto. My mother made us salads with fresh tarragon leaves mixed in with the lettuces. She made curtains with French seams. She grew tomato plants in the garden in the back, forgetting to water them until the leaves wilted and browned, her neglect making the fruit the sweetest. That summer, my father would not talk with me, but insisted that I babysit my brother, who had been missing me. I'd been over to his house several times to babysit, hoping to talk with him, but he had ignored me. After that, I told my father I would need to talk with him first, and that I wouldn't babysit unless he agreed to talk with me. But he refused, and said I had abandoned my brother. One afternoon, Kevin and Dorothy came over to my mother's house when my mother and I happened to be in a panic. My father had just called me, yelling that I had to babysit my brother, and then sent my mother an angry email. I was horrible and selfish, he wrote, shirking my responsibilities toward my brother. My mother and I were upset, not knowing how to respond. I suspected that, in some way, I must be wrong. I kept repeating to my father on the phone and then over email that I would love to see my brother, but would simply need to talk with him first.
I don't want to talk to you or see you, he said to me on the phone. You won't see Reed, and I love Reed, and I don't want to spend time with people who won't spend time with the people I love, he said.
Dorothy stood over my mother and dictated a response that began, "Cut the sanctimonious bullshit, Steve." My mother typed it out. Dorothy spelled out sanctimonious. I was thrilled about Dorothy's response and the new word. At Harvard, I decided to major in English. During my junior year, I took a seminar on Chaucer's Troilus and Cresside, taught by a Chaucer scholar from England with charming and even teeth and tufts of white hair in his ears. At some point, Cresside has left Troilus, but Troilus can't seem to forget her. It makes Troilus seem so pathetic, I said confidently during the seminar, that he can't get over her. No, the professor said, looking at me with a kind gaze. His strength is that he can hold on. That spring, soon after I wrote what I took to be a rather poignant villanelle about my eyebrows and entered it for submission in the college literary magazine, I went to see a free campus therapist, writing my name on a sign-up sheet to reserve an hour. She was a thin woman with a thin voice and thin hair, a thin face, and a thin nose, like a Modigliani woman, with a peaceful expression and a sense of calm around her. I went to see her a few times over the course of the next few weeks. And before the last session, at the end of the year, I told her about a dream I'd had the night before. I was sitting on a cliff, looking out over the vast ocean, where my father was sitting at his desk under a cone of light. The desk was like a raft, and the whole work raft was drifting out to sea as he concentrated on the screen. "He'll go away," she said, a sad note in her voice. "And then maybe someday he'll realize that he did the same thing to you that was done to him." I was surprised that she could make such a quick summary, and I assumed something so quick and short must be wrong. But later when I thought about it, it seemed true. I thought of my family as unique, but it must not have been. And I was surprised that it could be so obvious. This was around the time my father had started working at Apple again. I read about it in the papers, and before I left to study abroad in London during my senior year, the first advertisements of the colorful new IMAX appeared, shrink-wrapped around the buses in Harvard Yard. Over the next summer, I stayed in Cambridge to work at the Harvard travel guide company, Let's Go, as an assistant editor for the Southeast Asia Guidebook. Halfway through the summer, I received a notice from Harvard in the mail saying that my tuition for the following year hadn't been paid. After I moved out on the night of the circus 2 years before, my father had stopped paying for other expenditures besides tuition, flights to and from college, books, and spending money. I'd been paying for these with money from work and help from Kevin and Dorothy. The next day, I wound my way down a dark basement corridor for a meeting with a Harvard financial aid officer. The man sat at a desk facing the door. Behind him, in the corner of the room, a ceiling tile was missing and a piece of insulation had started to come loose. I explained that my father had decided not to pay my tuition, even though he could afford to do so. "You'll have to drop out until the age of majority," he said. "What's the age of majority?" I asked, hoping it was 21. 25, he said. I deflated. In college, I had two jobs, one as an ESL teacher and one in the university development office, where the word development meant raising money for the college through fundraisers and advertising. I had assumed the financial aid office would look something like the development office, money in, money out. In fact, this office and this man seemed beleaguered, as if to communicate that Harvard didn't have the money one might think it had. I was furious at this man for his no-nonsense talk. There must be a way to make it work. Surely Harvard would want to help me, to keep me, I thought, when in fact it was this man's job to inform me that it did not.
"Harvard financial aid is need-based," he said.
My father's status rendered me ineligible for any aid. "So I just have to drop out? There's nothing Harvard will do to help me stay?"
"That's correct," he said.
"Absolutely nothing." When he came to Boston for business, Kevin took me for dinner. I liked these dinners because they made college less lonely. It made me feel like other people who sometimes went to dinner with their fathers, even if he wasn't my father. Sometimes he seemed competitive with my father.
"He might have nice cars," Kevin said at dinner,
"but he doesn't really know how to drive." Good driving, as Kevin defined it, involved making the passenger comfortable, unaware of the speed and acceleration of the car. If this was true, my father did not have that skill. His driving was like a wire in my stomach. He fishtailed through curves. Before my father's success at Pixar and his new job at Apple, Kevin talked about my father's poor business acumen, how Next was doing poorly. Worse than other people might know, which you could tell because he had stopped buying things, Kevin said. I listened and nodded. But my father had rarely bought much, compared with other rich people, and none of these attributes made me care about him less or diminished his importance to me. He could have been the worst executive and the worst driver in the world.
"He doesn't love you," Kevin said to me.
"Love is what you do." "Maybe you're right," I said, and contemplated the idea. It was a stab at first. But after that, it felt almost like a relief to say it like it was.
How dare Kevin say that? He does love you, my mother said on the phone when I told her.
But love is a verb, I said. So what does it matter?
It matters, she said.
I thought maybe she didn't know. I experimented with the idea as I walked around. He doesn't love me, and that's why he's like this. The plain truth. Kevin and Dorothy paid my tuition for my final year. My mother said she had tried to sell her new house to pay for it, but there wasn't much time and she couldn't find a buyer. She also said she had a vision of an enormous, brilliant gold angel towering behind the neighbors. It was impossible, I knew, but the image made the gift easier to receive. If I could imagine the money came from an angel and not just from them, whom I worried I could never repay. The gift was unfathomably big. At times I wished that these stable, responsible neighbors were my family instead. And if I yearned to be good enough for a family like this, they might have liked being an example to me and delighted in how I saw them heroically. They were often cracking jokes and giving me ideas about how people lived and how families interacted and how I shouldn't interrupt and what questions were rude and how to defend myself with my words and how to think about the people who fawned on my father and stepmother and did not notice or care about me. I flipped back and forth between wanting to be exactly like them and wanting to be myself, with them as my doting parents. For a while, perhaps, all of us were caught up in the wish that we could be a family. My mother called a friend to ask him what he thought would come of all of this. He said,
Lisa's going to find out she can't replace her parents. And Kevin and Dorothy are going to learn they can't buy a daughter.
I had already committed to study abroad at King's College in London for my final year of college, and Kevin and Dorothy insisted that I go. That year, near my dorm, the London Eye was lifted from the surface of the water. Toward the end of my year abroad, I dated an English lawyer with a high-standing blonde ruffle of hair.
You should invite your father to your graduation, he said.
No way, I said. I told him everything my father had done wrong.
But he's your father, he said.
He kept pressing, saying that it didn't matter what one's father had done, he was still one's father. The fathers had done worse things and still should be invited to momentous events. And if I didn't invite him, I'd regret it later when it was too late to fix. I was ambivalent. But in the end, I sent my father and Lorene two tickets and a note. Kevin and Dorothy, whom I invited and who planned to come, were deeply hurt that I'd invited my father after all they had done for me when he had not and decided not to come. My mother was worried she wouldn't be able to afford the trip, but at the last minute, she got a consulting job with Hewlett-Packard, bought a flight, reserved a hotel room, and bought a stunning black cotton dress that was ruched up at the bottom like a parachute. Later, when my father talked about that day, he said several times, "Your mother was so graceful." He did not know what I knew, that she carefully rationed her words to him, giving him a maximum of 25. To him, she spoke deliberately and carefully to protect this economy. My father and Lorene had slipped through the river gate of Winthrop House to watch me walk down the line and receive my diploma. When I came to join my mother, I found them standing beside her.
"I don't believe in genetics," my father blurted out after we'd exchanged hellos.
He sometimes made pronouncements like this. At other times, he had talked about how powerful genes were. I didn't know how to respond.
"What are you going to do next? Do you have a job?" he asked.
I was almost too embarrassed to say, because I knew he didn't respect banking, or what he called the straight and narrow, and neither did I, and I withered under my imagination of his judgment.
"Tell him,"
my mother nudged me, and I mumbled it. I would be starting work as an analyst at a bank in London. It was the wrong kind of job for an English major, and I felt foolish to have joined the normal hubbub of the world, and for being one of the people my father sometimes mocked, but Schroeder, Salomon, Smith, Barney would get me a visa so that I could live and work in London. I would be able to support myself. After graduation, I would see my father once a year, if that. My younger sister, Eve, was born when I was away at college, but in a few magazines I came across in the following years and on his bio on his company website, he said he had 3 children, not 4. Sometimes he would be wonderful, but then he would say something unkind, so that I found myself guarded around him, happy to stay away. A few weeks after graduation, my mother asked Kevin and Dorothy to provide a sheet with a detailed accounting of everything they'd spent on me, including the flights, books, vacations, and clothing for school. She sent this piece of paper to my father, and shortly after, he paid them back. When I was 27, no longer at the bank, but working at a graphic design company in London, my father invited me to join a yacht trip that he, Lorene, my siblings, and the babysitter were taking in the Mediterranean. He invited me for a weekend, but then implored me to stay for a few more days when the weekend was up. After those days were up, he asked me to stay longer again, until I had stayed as long as I could, for more than 2 weeks. Off the coast of the south of France, my father said we were going to make a stop in the Alps Maritimes to meet a friend for lunch. He wouldn't say who the friend was. We took a boat to the dock, where a van picked us up and took us to a lunch at a villa in Eze. It turned out to be Bono's villa. He met us out front wearing jeans, a t-shirt, and the same sunglasses I'd seen him wearing in pictures and on album covers. He seemed plain, and he was kind, without the awkward distance usually affected by famous people. He gave us an exuberant tour of his house, as if he couldn't quite believe it was his. The windows faced the Mediterranean, and the rooms were cluttered with children's things. In an empty, light-filled octagonal room, he said Gandhi once slept. We had lunch on a large covered balcony overlooking the sea. I sat a few seats away from my father, who sat beside Bono at the head of the table. Waiters delivered food. Bono asked my father about the beginning of Apple. Did the team feel alive? Did they sense it was something big and they were going to change the world? My father said it did feel that way as they were making the Macintosh. And Bono said it was that way for him and the band too. And wasn't it incredible that people in such disparate fields could have the same experience? Then Bono asked, "So was the Lisa computer named after her?" There was a pause. I braced myself, prepared for his answer. My father hesitated, looked down at his plate for a long moment, and then back at Bono. "Yeah, it was," he said. I sat up in my chair. "I thought so," Bono said. "Yep," my father said. I studied my father's face. What had changed? Why had he admitted it now, after all these years? Of course it was named after me, I thought then. His lie seemed preposterous now. I felt a new power that pulled my chest up. "That's the first time he said yes," I told Bono. "Thank you for asking." It was as if famous people needed other famous people around to release their secrets. A few years later, I was living in New York. I went to visit my father in Palo Alto, and he wanted to go out for sushi, just the two of us. By this point, I knew he was sick with cancer. He was very thin. Over the past month in New York, it occurred to me that I should say the good things to him before it was too late. Even if I had no sense of how sick he was, I believed he might soon recover. "You know, in many ways, you were good about sex," I told him. "Sex was our easiest subject." "When you put in a diaphragm," he'd lectured me in high school, "you have a moment all to yourself to decide again what you want to do." He had not insisted I take the pill, or worried openly about my becoming pregnant, instead giving the sense he trusted me, and knew me to be reasonable, profound even. "You didn't try to make me feel ashamed," I said. "Yes, yes," he said. He was hardly able to contain himself, bobbing his thin legs up and down in the seat beside me. We were in the car with the engine off because we had arrived at the sushi restaurant in the mall. "That's what I was trying for," he said. "And you know what? I was the first person you talked to after you lost your virginity," he said. "It was so great. It meant so much to me." I'd forgotten this before he mentioned it. "I know you better than I know the girls," he said, as we got out of the car and walked toward the restaurant. I didn't know what to say back. This was a shocking claim, considering I'd met him so late, and they lived with him their whole lives. It couldn't be true, I thought. That night I walked into his bedroom upstairs when he was watching old episodes of Law and Order. He'd asked me abruptly from bed, "Are you going to write about me?" "No," I said. "Good," he said, and turned back to face the television. My mother became sick, a sinus and bone infection that we couldn't diagnose at first, leaving her unable to work and unable to pay her rent. She had sold her house on Alameda de las Pulgas a few years before, against my wishes, and had used the money to travel and live for several years until the money ran out. Desperate, I called the parents of a friend from Nueva who offered her a place to live for a few months in their extra house in San Francisco. Another set of friends loaned me money to help her pay for oral surgery that made her cheek balloon out as if it had been stung by a bee. A few weeks later, I went to visit my father in the hospital in Memphis after he'd had a liver transplant. He'd gone to Memphis because that's where a liver became available. He and my stepmother flying there in his private jet late at night. Once, when he had to urinate, a nurse had tried to usher me out of the room. "She can stay," he'd said, and then proceeded to pee in a plastic jar under his gown while I stood there, talking to me as he peed, as if he couldn't be away from me for even 1 second. He'd had 2 rooms at the hospital, a room with his hospital bed and a small anteroom, and in the anteroom were a couch and chairs, like the kind at elementary schools, with melamine bodies and metal legs, and in order to visit, we had to move the chairs around, pushing the extras out of the way, making them clack. At one point, sitting in the anteroom with me and my aunt and stepmother, he started gasping for breath and turning purplish, and we all panicked, trying to find out what was wrong. I glanced down surreptitiously and noticed with dismay that the leg of my chair was crimping his oxygen tube. I moved my chair as quickly as I could, and he started to breathe again. Less than a year after the transplant, back at the Waverly house, the cancer had spread to the top of his femur and the outside lining of his gut. "What's it called?" I asked the nurse, Ellum. "It's called the superficial fascia," she said. I imagined it, the pouch holding his intestines together. And for some reason in my imagination, it was a phosphorescent skein, like a jellyfish or like city lights seen at night from an airplane. Inside the glowing outlines, it was dark. He was called Johnny 8 on the papers in the hospital. Sometimes he sucked on morphine lollipops. In the bed, sleeping, at certain angles, he looked like a pile of yellow bones. He couldn't walk anymore. "He's not in pain," Ellum reassured me. His brain, according to the MRI scan, was cancer-free. During my previous visit, he was still eating a little. He remained picky. If one type of mango touched another type of mango in the bowl, he turned away and would not eat. This time, he took only liquid food called TPN, intravenously at night, never long enough to gain weight. The process gave him 150 calories per hour. Only a few months after the visit, when he'd said I smelled like a toilet, I was still stealing small objects from around the house. I called my mother to tell her about what I was doing. I wanted her to absolve me. I wanted her to make an exception to the no-stealing rule just for me, just this time. I wanted her to say, "Honey, you can keep everything." But she said, "You've got to return their things. It's important. You must not steal. It's like Persephone." It was like her to make this mythical.
You know, the one who ate the pomegranate seeds. I remembered she'd gone to the underworld, where she wasn't supposed to touch anything. But she couldn't resist, and she ate the seeds. Then, as a punishment, she had to stay down there for part of the year. That was supposed to be why we have winter. I tried to remember how many seeds she took. It doesn't matter how many, my mother said. The point is, because she took the seeds, she was stuck there. She stole from the underworld. She partook of it. And then she was bound to it. And? If you keep those things, you're bound to that house. It doesn't free you. It ties you to it. Of course, the story of Persephone was also a story of a mother and daughter. A mother making the land barren because of her grief during the months her daughter was gone. I took the stolen items back in shifts because there were too many to take all at once. I wrapped the bowls in the pillowcases so they wouldn't clink. I put the lip gloss back on the shelf in the bathroom, the cream in the cabinet upstairs, the shoes in the closet. It turns out that to return stolen things and not get caught is just as difficult as stealing them in the first place. During this visit, my father did not seem particularly interested in seeing me. He asked me to leave the room so he could watch a movie with my brother. He could no longer walk or eat, but I believed in a delusional way that he'd live for a long time yet. He'd been sick for such a long time that I didn't notice when this changed into dying. I avoided his room, only forcing myself to go in sometimes and hoping that he'd be asleep when I did. At the end of the visit, I thought I might not return to see him again because it felt hollow and unsatisfying. But a month later, he texted. He didn't usually text me, asking me to visit during a weekend when Lorene and my siblings would be away. I took a train to Palo Alto from the San Francisco airport. The air was crisp and the light was sharp on the platform pilings. In New York, the air was flat. It rarely smelled of anything. Or it smelled of one thing, garbage or rain or perfume or smog. Here, the wind was cool. It carried water in it. Fog curled over the hills like other softer hills. The air smelled of eucalyptus and grasses, spice cake and menthol, wet dirt, dry dirt. I was skeptical that this trip would be different from the others. Mona had named me Ye of Little Faith a long time ago, and my mother called me that still to tease me. I got off at the California Avenue stop. The town had the look of nothing going on. The road straight like a runway to the deep green hills. I took the underpass below Alma Street that emerged in the golden light on the other side and walked past the park and the pine trees. The houses around here hugged the ground. For the previous 6 months, I'd been taking a small dose of clonazepam, an anti-anxiety drug that allegedly reduces the amygdala's fight-or-flight response, 0.25 milligram per day. It was despite, or perhaps because of, my father's insistence I try weed or LSD that drugs had seemed unappealing before. I'd never done any. The flying back and forth to see him every month, finishing graduate school, my mother sick and low on money. I had found myself unable to focus. Instead, I moved and talked faster and faster. I had a frantic quality, hoping to distract others and not expose myself. I was jittery and defensive and self-conscious, terrified my father would say something awful and then he would die and nothing would be resolved. In movies, there is the scene when the dying person apologizes. But this was life. I walked through the house and paused at the threshold of my father's study that had become his bedroom. There was a photograph by Harold Edgerton of an apple being shot through by a bullet, the skin fraying around the edges of the hole. I rounded the corner to his room. He was propped up on pillows, his legs pale and thin like knitting needles. There were framed photographs covering the surface of the chest of drawers, each tilted to face his bed. The chest had drawers of equal widths, and later I would see that inside he'd organized the art and photographs in each one. He was alone, awake.
and seemed to be waiting for me. He smiled.
"I'm so glad you're here," he said.
His warmth was disarming. Tears fell down his face. Before he was sick, I'd seen him cry only twice, once at his father's funeral, and once in a movie theater at the end of Cinema Paradiso, when I thought he was shivering.
"This is the last time you're going to see me," he said. "You're going to need to let me go."
"Okay," I said. But I didn't quite believe him. And I wouldn't have believed he'd die about a month later. I had fuzzy, indeterminate thoughts about how long he'd live. I sat on the bed beside him.
"I didn't spend enough time with you when you were little," he said. "I wish we'd had more time."
"It's fine," I said. He was so weak and fragile. I lay down on my side in his bed, facing him.
"No, it's not okay. I didn't spend enough time with you," he said. "I should have spent the time. Now it's too late."
"I guess our timing was off," I said, not convinced of it, even as I said it. In fact, I had recently realized my luck. I got to know him before he became hugely famous, when he was healthy enough to skate. I'd imagined he'd spend a lot more time with everyone else than he had with me, but I wasn't so sure about that anymore. He looked into my eyes and teared up.
"I owe you one."
I was not sure what to make of this phrase. During that weekend, he repeated it over and over.
"I owe you one. I owe you one," he said, crying, when I went to visit him in between his naps.
What I wanted, what I felt owed, was some clear place in the hierarchy of those he loved. He and I were alone in the house, except for the nurses who rotated every 6 hours. A few other people came to visit, people he'd worked with. A few people he didn't know came to the doors wanting to see him too, wandering into the garden with packages, or empty-handed. A stranger in a sari begged to talk with him. A man came in through the gate and said he had flown in from Bulgaria just to see my father. A cluster of people gathered at the side door, talked among themselves, and then dispersed.
"Do you remember your dreams?"
I was lying on my side in his bed. He was drifting in and out of sleep.
"Yep."
"Have you always remembered them?"
"Most of the time."
"What do you dream about?"
"Work mostly," he said. "Trying to convince people of things."
"What things?"
"Ideas."
"Ideas you thought of while you were dreaming?"
"Sometimes. But usually in my dreams I can't convince them. Usually they're too much of a bozo to get it."
"Did you come up with a lot of ideas that way, in your dreams?"
"Yes," he said, then fell asleep again.
The next day I went to the hospital with him for a blood transfusion. This took up most of the day because he was too weak to walk and had to be transported from chair to car to chair to hospital to chair to car to chair and back into his bed again. The blood was thick and dark in the bag. It looked like fake syrup Dracula blood. The hospital brought him heated blankets that came out of a machine that looked like a refrigerator. He was cold and then hot and then cold. I sat on a chair in the room with him, hearing the mechanical whoosh of the machine. I wondered whose blood he was getting. I wanted to ask, but I didn't want to call attention to the bag. He had a transfusion every 10 days or so. It took several hours. Afterward, he had more color. "He's cold, I think," I told one of the nurses toward the end of the transfusion.
"I'm fine," he said.
I sat on the chair in the corner to wait for him. "I think he might be cold," I said again a few minutes later. I could feel gusts of cold air blowing through the vents.
I'm fine, he said, and I had to leave the room for some reason. And when I called back in to sit on the chair in the corner, the nurse brought me a blanket. He said you were cold, she said. I hadn't noticed I was. I'm sorry I didn't spend more time with you. I'm so sorry, he said from the bed. I guess you were working really hard, and that's why you didn't email me or call me back. He'd rarely returned my emails and calls, did not mark my birthdays. No. He paused. It wasn't because I was busy. It was because I was mad you didn't invite me to the Harvard weekend. What weekend? The introductory weekend. All I got was the bill, he said, with a catch in his voice. Matriculation. I remembered later how, when I was 18, I'd been carefully juggling my parents, who didn't want to come at the same time, and we decided, with the help of my therapist, and the agreement of both parents, that she would come that weekend and he'd come a few weekends later. At the time, he'd agreed that this was best. Why didn't you tell me? I'm not too good at communication. I wish I could take it back, or change it, I said. It seemed unlikely and possibly insane that our relationship was pinned on one weekend. I didn't believe it. I described some sort of overarching wisdom to him. But people who are dying and trying to set things right aren't necessarily reflective and profound. I didn't buy the idea that one invitation, one weekend, could have justified his 10 years of almost silence and the withholding of money for college tuition in my final year. All through those years, I'd been looking at my palm. I was meant for a good life. That was what the lines meant. I remembered how, a year before, my mother had come to visit me in New York. She was getting over the illness that had left her fragile and her ears clogged. We went for a walk in the late afternoon. West 4th Street intersected Charles Street at a brick row house covered in light. My mother and I stopped to gaze at it together. Those days, we had started to have the feeling that we had survived. We had made it through. We would be happy. And the palms? Do you even know how to read palms? I'd built up the courage to ask. Sort of, she said, a slight smile that meant she was lying. I mean, do you have any expertise? What I wanted her to say was she'd met someone in India or she'd read a rare book. You needed the right stories. We needed to get to a radically different place from where we were. I didn't know how else to get us there. Besides stories. And anyway, the things I was saying, they were true. That evening, back at the house, he called me in with the weak voice he used to call the nurses. Lise? The backpack that held the bag of TPN was whirring its motor, ticking like a toy train around a track, the milky fluid going into his veins. He was lying on the bed with his knees up, propped up on pillows. He was freakishly thin. It was hard to look at him and think of anything else besides his limbs, his gaunt face. About what we said earlier, he said. It struck me how he referenced a previous conversation about emotions, something he'd never done with me before. I want to say something. You are not to blame. He started to cry. If only we'd had a manual. If only I'd been wiser. But you were not to blame. I want you to know. You were not to blame for any of it. He'd waited to apologize until there was hardly anything left of him. This was what I'd been waiting to hear. It felt like cool water on a burn. I'm so sorry, Lise. He cried and shook his head side to side. He was sitting up, cradling his head in his hands, and because he had shrunk and lost fat, his hands looked disproportionately large, and his neck too thin to hold his skull.
like one of the Rodin sculptures of the burghers of Calais. I wish I could go back. I wish I could change it. But it's too late. What can I do now? It's just too late. He cried, and his body shook. His breath caught on his sobs, and I wish he'd stop. After that, he said again, I owe you one. I didn't know what to say. I kept sitting beside him on his bed. Even now, I didn't quite trust it. If by some miracle he recovered, I imagined he'd snap back to his old self, forget this happened, go back to treating me as he had before. Well, I'm here now, I said. Maybe, if there is a next time, we could be friends. It was also a gentle jab. Just friends. But in fact, in the weeks following this visit, and after he died, it was our missed chance at friendship I grieved about. Okay, he said. But I'm so sorry. I owe you one. Since returning the stolen objects, I hadn't taken anything else. But I'd still noticed other things I wanted. Now the wanting dried up. I never felt like stealing again. The family returned and the house was bustling. In the evening after dinner, Lorraine and I were alone at the kitchen table together. On other visits, I would have hopped up to wash the dishes, but this time I stayed where I was. He talked to me, I said. We exchanged important words. Momentous words. I feel better. I thought she would ask me about it. But instead, she got up to wash a dish at the sink. I don't believe in deathbed revelations, she said. My younger sister Eve was having a birthday party. I wandered out into the garden that smelled of succulents, geraniums, and water. A cluster of girls stood on the darkening lawn, with some light still in the sky, like a Magritte painting. My sister had tied low strings like tripwires over the surface of the large outdoor trampoline to imitate horse jumps, and she and her friends did jumps on arms and legs across the surface. Birds flew into the eaves of the house, and the pug grunted and rooted around beside the trampoline legs. "Who are you?" one girl asked me. She was a few inches taller than my sister, up to my nose, hair like straw. My sister climbed off the trampoline and stood nearby. "I'm the sister of the birthday girl," I said. The friend looked confused. Maybe because we are 21 years apart. "I'm much older because we have different mothers," I said to explain. "Oh," the girl said. "It's nice to meet you." "She was Daddy's mistake," my sister announced. I grabbed her shoulders for a minute to steady myself, her back against my chest. "You shouldn't say that," I whispered in her ear, and then walked back into the house through the dark. Inside there was a honey jar on the kitchen table, and I leaned closer to inspect the label. On it were five illustrations of bees with the names of the family members written underneath each. Steve, Lorraine, Reed, Aaron, and Eve. Above them was the title, Jobs Family Farm. The next day, in a drawer below the napkins, I found a cluster of many of these labels, each with an adhesive back. They were for gifts, I figured. There were so many labels that they clung together and fanned out like the fall leaves raked into tight piles on the streets around here. I kept looking at the labels, searching for my name among the bees, as if it might appear there. In the dining hall in college, a girl had said, half-joking, "The trick must be to marry rich. How do we marry rich?" And I felt the same heaviness of being outside the circle of fun. In the past couple of years, I'd moved to New York, finished an MFA at Bennington College, started a consulting job at a graphic design firm editing and designing a section of the MoMA website, and moved in with a man I loved and hoped to marry. I'd grown up. I'd moved on. So it surprised me, returning to see my father when he was sick, how painful it still was not to be included in his life. Visiting reminded me that while I'd lived at this house,
I'd wish to be someone else. But around this time, during one of these visits, during these strange years flying here to visit my father every month or so, I had a moment of revelation, a moment of lightness, as if a huge burden I'd been carrying around had been lifted all at once as I was standing under the frill of jasmine around the front door. It was irrelevant that I wasn't named on the honeypots. I had not been a mistake. I was not the useless part of something meaningful. I heard from someone that the pattern of our breath isn't supposed to be even, regular. Humans are not metronomes. It goes long and short, deep and shallow. And that's how it's supposed to go, depending at each moment on what you need and what you can get and how filled up you are. I wouldn't trade any part of my experience for someone else's life, I felt then, even the moments where I'd wished I didn't exist. Not because my life was right or perfect or best, but because the accumulation of choices made had carved a path that was characteristic and distinct down to the serif, and I felt the texture of it all around me for just a moment. Familiar. Like my own skin. And it was good enough. At the memorial service, and in the years since, people want me to know how close they were with my father. He liked giving special advice to my son, someone said. They were very close. They had such a tight relationship, another said of her son and my father. He was like a father to me, said a man, tearing up. These conversations have a particular quality in which I feel I am supposed to be, more than a participant, a witness. These people do not ask about my father, but talk fervently at me, as if my listening is the missing ingredient, the yeast that gives their stories life. They recite anecdotes like speeches and walk away. Do they want me to feel deferential? He'd been like a father to them too. They're asserting a claim, and I'm supposed to confirm him as the Ur-Father, his great greatness. When people speak and write about my father's meanness, they sometimes assume that meanness is linked to genius, that to have one is to get closer to the other. But the way I saw him create was the best part of him. Sensitive, collaborative, fun. The friends he worked with got to see this more than I did. Maybe the meanness protected the part that created, so that acting mean to approximate genius is as foolish as trying to be successful by copying his lisp or his walk or the way he turned around and wagged his hands around his back and moaned to pretend he was making out. Look at those clouds, he'd said once when he was sick but could still walk, in a sweet mood, pointing up out of the window on a sunny day. Those clouds are approximately 10,000 feet up. That's about 2 miles. If we wanted, you and I, we could walk. Let's see, a 20-minute mile. We could be there in 40 minutes, he said. Rinpoche, the Brazilian monk, said to my mother that if he'd had 2 more months, just 2 months, he could have achieved a better resolution between my parents. But who knows? When I see my mother now, the more time we spend together, the more I feel attached. When I have to pee, I leave the door open so we can keep talking. We are like suction cups. Once together, it's difficult to pry us apart. Sometimes we fight. When we're apart, she on her coast and me on mine, I forget how it is to be together, how it's exhilarating and up and down. When she visits New York, we go see art. At the Agnes Martin exhibition at the Guggenheim, we start at the top and corkscrew to the bottom, against the traffic of people walking up, looking at stripes. For us, Agnes gets younger and younger. After that, we walk out into the day, across Fifth Avenue to Central Park, and she says, "Look," and points to the thick white lines against the dark asphalt. "There's another one." There was one picture of my parents together before I was born. They are standing at the train station one morning when my father left to return to Reed College. My mother's cheeks are round and full. She's wearing jeans.
My father's face is pale and sweet. They look incredibly young. I thought it was my mother who lost things. Houses, objects, my father. But she had kept this picture from